You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 317, when is a band not a band? What if there are no original members left? We look at things in life that bring us joy and 50 years of gay rights. But is it really time to celebrate? It's all coming up after Cosmic Rough Riders and Melanie.
Guaranteed you'll be singing Customs at JFK wouldn't let me through in your head for the rest of the day. The splendid Cosmic Rough Riders and Melanie. And welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 317. I'm Terence Stackham, and they'll let her through at JFK. It's Juliet Harris.
Hello, yes, thank you very much indeed. I've never been to JFK. I wish that I had the kind of jet-setty lifestyle, which meant that I did. Having said that, years ago, I used to write for a TV reviewing website, and I reviewed something called The Model Agency on Channel 4 once, which was schlock, but quite enjoyable. And they had one of the, I can't remember if it was Elite or Select that it was based at, but one of the major agencies. And there was a woman that was kind of in charge of things. And I remember her telling a story, it was all quite camp, as you can imagine, and she was telling a story apropos of nothing about how one must never take a Tupperware box of liver salts through customs.
Oh gosh, I say.
I think she had quite a time. So yes, that's a tip. If you probably would stop you at JFK if you were carrying that, I would think.
Now, Jules, we had a really good suggestion from regular listener Mark Howson, who...
Yes, indeed, has shout-out to Mark, and now one of our growing band of executive producers.
Indeed, yeah, tweeted us the question, are a band who now exist without any of the original members able still really to be considered that band? And he gives us an example, the German prog rock group Embryo, who are still trading, but without any original members. And he alludes to the point that if Marky Smith left The Fall... could the band carry on as The Fall?
As he said, if it's me and your granny on bongos, it's The Fall, as Marky Smith once said.
Well, this business of can the name continue has reached some absurd heights. One bizarre example is Gene Loves Jezebel, they're a sort of indie goth band who had some success in the 1980s.
Yes, it felt a bit fleeting, though, although apologies to Gene Loves Jezebel if I am incorrectly writing them off.
Well, they had, they had identical twin brothers, Jay Aston and Michael Aston, in the group. But in the 90s, rather sadly, the brothers fell out. Various court cases have followed over the years. And this has led now to the rather strange situation of there now being two touring and recording groups, Jay Aston's Gene Loves Jezebel and Michael Aston's Loves Jezebel.
So that's not great.
Let's hope they never end up on the same bill. But Jules, they're not alone in this see you in court wrangle over band names.
No, indeed not. And they're not alone as being brothers that fall out and then having two bands as well. The curious case of UB40. There are two UB40 versions that are touring at the moment, with Ali and Robin Campbell having fallen out, the brothers. And somewhat alarmingly, I have to say, this summer, isn't it nice that there's no Labour leadership contest? I feel so
makes
relaxed.
A change. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes, I feel so chilled. But last summer, when there was, of course, the pitched battle of the Labour leadership contest, the only reason I became aware of the fact there were two UB40s is that Jeremy Corbyn trumpeted the endorsement of UB40. I think it was Ali Campbell's lot. I can't remember which lot. I think it was the actual lot, to say, oh, yes, they support us. And there was lots of Mickey taking about how it wasn't exactly the youth market they were going for. And then the other UB40 emerged and said that actually they were backing Owen Smith's campaign. So UB40, not only were there two touring versions, there were two factional Labour Party versions as well. So, thinking about this concept of can a group be, you know, the lineup changes, to what extent do lineup changes stop you? So I was DJing at a wedding earlier this week, and it's difficult to get the crowd going, not sure what people wanted. Fortunately, the best man was a very nice man who was extremely camp and requested lots of pop, which then lots of people got on the floor and enthusiastically danced to, and I played Push the Button by Sugar Babes. We then had a chat about Sugar Babes, me and someone else, how they were nicknamed by Peter Robinson of Pop Justice as the Trigger's Broom of Pop, in that they had, you know, many handles and many heads, but were still the same broom. They had various lineup changes to the point where, at the time, I remember saying to someone that Sugar Babes had become the equivalent of a national service, and that I was expecting my call up to be in the Sugar Babes for a period of 6 months at some point in the future. So the rotating Sugar Babes, and in the end they collapsed because someone else, one of the second generation Sugar Babes, left, and I think they realised that the whole thing was ridiculous. And then the original three Sugar Babes, all of whom had left by this point, then formed their own band using their first names as a kind of a provisional Sugar Babes type arrangement. So yeah, a band's changing, very confusing, I think.
Well, I think once a band has been in existence for a good length of time, especially I suppose those from the 50s and 60s, this membership of that band becomes a bit fluid, as per your Sugar Babes. And I was thinking there'd been about 50 blokes in the Temptations since their 60s heyday. And that in turn got me thinking about when I was asked to book out the Tremolos, 1960s and early 70s hot pop band, the Tremolos. And I was asked to book them out as a vintage act, and I booked them into colleges, and they were rather shamefully seen as a sort of novelty act from the past, and I rather patronisingly thought of them as elderly gents as they went round on the sort of rag week circuit, because the clubs and usual venues didn't want to know them anymore. But here's the twist. This was 1974 when I was sending them out as a vintage act, and it was only 3 years since their last Top 40 hit, but they were already seen as has-beens by the clubs. And nightclubs. And I was 18, and these blokes from the Tremolos I was talking to as if they were pensioners were 29 and 30 years old. And this all ties in as the Tremolos are still touring with three original members, and they're all over the UK this autumn as Brian Poole and the Tremolos. And it's incredible. 2017, and I thought they were vintage in 1974.
No, that is ridiculous, isn't it? That's quite a thing, isn't it? That we think that they are still already dried up.
But the next track we're going to play is from a band who you also have a story about in the same context of their ever-changing members.
Well, yes, indeed. Well, I mean, I don't know if this is an ever-changing members, because they were very much a kind of a one-man band anyway, I think. But I, being a Britpop nostalgist, went to see Sleeper. Some people might remember the mid-90s band Sleeper, who had a surprising number of hits. Actually, they announced that they were doing a little tour. There's some people called Starshaped who are increasingly popular, that promote kind of Britpop revival type events. I think there's a festival this weekend of various kind of Britpop B-list acts that are playing, and so they did a few warm-up dates. So I went to see Sleeper at the Haunt with a couple of friends of mine in Brighton, I think it was last weekend, and the support band were a band called My Life Story, who I remembered as being kind of, again, sort of also rans in the mid-90s. They're led by a chap called Jake Shillingford, who I made a person in the queue behind us laugh when I said to someone, well, he was always champagne ideals on beer money. I mean, I felt a bit sorry for him, really, because I think he really wanted to be a star, except someone rather crudely pointed out, you'd think he was trying to ape Morrissey, but in fact it seemed like he was aping Brett Anderson, who was aping Morrissey in the first place, really. He wrote these very ornate kind of grand pop songs, and in those days he could afford an orchestra to tour with him. The record company would have it. Nowadays, not so much. When we saw them play in this club, he's still going, and, you know, he's still in fine voice. I don't even know if he had an original band to start off with, or if it was just him and sessioners. We were trying to work this out. But anyway, the band that he had on this occasion, four people, they were my age or younger, I would say. So the chances of them even being kind of around at the time of him doing these hits were not large anyway, really. And I did note that two of his band were then utilised as additional musicians for Sleeper when they came on. There was a girl that played keyboards who did very well, considering she was having to play an organ and an entire string orchestra on synths for this song that we're gonna play next. But I thought it was very, I mean, Sleeper were fantastic, and we really, really enjoyed Sleeper. They were great, and Louise Wiener was quite knowing about the fact that everyone was there because they were 20 years older. And it was, we also said, just goes to show how configured it was around people of a certain age and babysitters. We were told the gig was 7 until 10, so we got there for doors at something like 7:30, I think, or 7:20, and it was already half full, which one wouldn't expect. We were told that My Life Story was due on 8, and they came on at 8 exactly. We were told they would play for half an hour, and they did, and they finished on this tune that we're about to play, and then they went off. We were told that Sleep would be on at 9, and they were on at 9:01, and we were told that they would play until 10, and they finished at 10:02, and then we all filed out. And you know, I don't care if people think that's old and boring. That is my kind of dream gig, really. That was perfect. So we'll play this now, shall we? Do you want to trail what we're going to be back with?
Well, we've looked at some heavy duty topics over the last few weeks, so we thought,
yeah, we have been a bit Captain Bringdown.
We thought we'd plunge in the opposite direction and talk about the things in life that bring us joy, and that's next after My Life Story.
She prefers the night.
And I have to say, it just goes to show the kind of the problems that My Life Story had, really, and why they were never as big as poor old Jake wanted them to be. Because the set that they did, my friend said halfway through, this is very much of its time, isn't it? It was all, I mean, there was one song they played which literally could have been anybody from the Britpop era, but they played that song, 12 Reasons Why, last, and we realised at that point that their issue was they didn't have any songs that were anywhere near as good as that, which, to be fair, is excellent. And there was a lot of joy. Everyone shouted the numbers out and we sung along, and so yeah, very, very big fans of that. It is a fantastic song, I think. It's enjoyably overwrought.
I'm all in favour also of any night out ending by 10 p.m. That sounds to me very civilised.
Perfect. Why do people not do more of this?
No idea. All gigs, in my view, should all start earlier and end earlier. It's ludicrous.
And what they did was, what was so perfect about it was, someone said, oh, there is an after party afterwards, which was a star-shaped club night down the road. And I thought it was wonderful that they separated the gig and the after party. Mm. I wonder how heavily attended the after party was. But I thought that was great, that you could have gone on if you wanted to, but you didn't have to. And that was excellent.
Now, in a world that where the news is usually dominated by grim stories, sometimes it's kind of valuable to step back and think about what it is in life that makes us happy, brightens us up, or even just brings warm consolation in a busy, slightly crazy world. We've each thought of three things that do that. And Jules, tell us the first two things in the world that bring you joy.
Well, actually, this first thing, I mean, usually, it's a topic which has brought me a lot of non-joy over the last kind of few years. So,
is it me?
Well, no, you bring me. You are the Jupiter of my personal sphere, bringer of joy. So listeners will know that I am politically very depressed and have been for some time. You know this as well. Mm. Everyone knows this. One thing, and I was talking about this with a friend of mine, who's my friend that I spent election night with, who is a fellow traveller in many ways. We were talking yesterday about the joy of politicians being silly. And people being able to be silly and lighthearted about Westminster politics. And we don't feel we've been able to do that for ages. The excellent Parley app have recently they got a photographer on swearing in day to take a picture of every single MP, which are available on their website. And the journalist Marie LeConte, who did write for BuzzFeed, she's now a freelancer, I think, said, Can I pitch to someone to write 2,000 words about these portraits? And people started to write their own interpretations of these politicians and what they look like. And some of them were brilliant. Something like someone said, Peter Bone is literally the man in front of the queue in Waitrose in an overcoat, furious that they've run out of Coleman's mustard. And they very much continued in that vein. And we had a go ourselves. So there was a picture of Amber Rudd, and I felt that she had the look of a woman who attended a drinks function and bumped into somebody whose husband she'd stolen 10 months ago and was having to do the whole Linda hi type thing. And Christopher Chope looked very much like someone who was incredulous that, having just been convicted at punching his next door neighbour at the climax of a decade-long dispute over a garden fence. And so I very much enjoyed being stupid about politics this week. Another couple of examples of this. Possibly the most niche joke ever, but I found this hilarious. So we've just talked about 12 Reasons Why by My Life Story, and it started, and as you've just heard, they list the things. So they go one, and then they list something, and two, and then they list something. The journalist from one of the political correspondents from the Daily Mirror, it turns out, is a large fan of My Life Story, and he put up a photoshopped picture of the Ed Miliband stone, which instead of saying one, a country where each generation can do better than last, it said one, she prefers the night to day, and listed all the My Life Story lyrics, which I thought was hilarious. And finally, the thing that has brought me great joy, speaking of our sugar babes, they had a song called Push the Button, which has given its name to a monthly pop night at the Royal Vauxhall Tavern in London. Mm. And I don't think it's specifically a gay night, although obviously it has a large gay following. I've never been. I'd love to go. It looks fantastic. And they had a referendum last night, which was Minogue versus Minogue. Mm. So they had lots of posters up with Soft Kylie and Hard Danny on them, as you can imagine, and they somehow managed to persuade Emily Thornberry to attend the event with her daughter, which she did, and she was the returning officer. Mm. So she got on stage with a piece of paper and said, I, Emily Thornberry, and they read out the votes, and I just thought that was enjoyably ridiculous, really. So one of the things that brings me great joy is politicians being silly. Mm. And the idea, or rather, you know, the fact that not everything has to be desperately serious all the time, because if I take one more politically serious day, I think I might scream. So actually, politicians being daft, I think, or people being able to be daft about politics and being able to look at an official portrait of Mary Cray and saying, I'm a cool mum, I'd rather you drunk inside the house. You know, things like that are just fantastic. So I am a big fan of that. That's brought me a lot of joy this week. Something else that brings me joy in a kind of a I don't care if you will write in and complain type way is the fact that I am, every year we have coming out day, and you know, you're meant to write that you're gay on Facebook, and that's fine, and to play on the fact that this is no revelation at all, I'm very open about it. This year I came out as a Coldplay fan, and that caused, I think, more horror and more difficulty than the fact that I was actually gay. Is it just, are you sure it's not just a phase you like in Coldplay? How long have you liked Coldplay for? What if my children like Coldplay? What should I do? Lots of helpful comments. And I love Coldplay. I don't care that they're not cool. I don't care that they're not the most musically complex band ever. I really don't care. I liked them when I first heard Yellow in 2000. I've liked them since. I like everything they do. I think I like the fact they have these enormous uplifting gigs with lots of basic wristbands. I think that's fantastic. I think they've done a great deal for good causes and charity over the years. And my mum loves Coldplay, and I love my mum. So Coldplay, one of my great joys, I'm afraid.
Every time I see them on TV or hear their songs on the radio, I really warm to them. And like you, I know, I believe it's considered, you know, uncool to like Coldplay, but I really warm to them. Really consistent band. But it's funny you mentioned Yellow. That first album, you just threw me back a memory there. The autumn of 2000, and it was when that Yorkshire lass that was living with me decided to head away into the sunset. As
how dare she?
So
honestly,
many women have done.
What's more on anyway? Carry on.
But the thing was, the sofa and the chairs in our living room were hers, so she took them with her.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I ordered new stuff and everything, but it was going to take about 8 weeks to get there or something. So for about 8 weeks, I sat in this more or less empty sitting room where we had lived in harmony until she decided to go. And
so I'm screwing her, yes.
Get back to Yorkshire with you. And
Let's not, please don't write in if you're.
But the but the album,
a personal thing rather than a specific thing.
The album that really got me through that. I spent many evenings. I wasn't in despair. I kind of saw it coming. It was okay. But I sat on the floor for many weeks listening to Coldplay's first album. And it, whenever I hear that, which is great, and it also fits in with our maxim that we've said before in being a very short album.
Yes, it is. It's one side of a C90, which is the rule.
Exactly. And I've really, to be honest, I've loved them ever since. But that first album has got no filler on it. It's absolutely great album.
It's
and
perfect.
It's suited my mood at the time as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's beautifully formed. And how weird that you should tell that story, because my sort of memories of Coldplay also involved me sitting on the floor listening to Yellow, because I remember it was the summer that I'd done my GCSEs, and it was my first experience of what it's like to go from 90 miles an hour to nothing. Mm. And I found it very strange. It was a very odd summer. I think I was depressed looking back on it. And don't write in any wags saying, well, no wonder you liked Coldplay then. But we were having loads of renovations done in our house at the time. And for some reason, there were no carpets for quite a long time. I don't know why. We were never middle class enough to have wooden floors. So I think it was just bad admin on our part. And I remember feeling a bit down and a bit sad and sitting on my floor, which had no carpet on it at all. And Steve Lamacq played Yellow on the radio on the evening session. And I just thought it was fantastic. So obviously, Coldplay, very good for sort of sparsely furnished rooms.
My first two picks of Joybringers are so obvious that every long-term listener could have picked them for me, Sport and Music.
Yeah.
And so it's no coincidence that really the only thing in life that makes me tense and agitated is football. Now, I can't wait for the Premier League to return in a few weeks, but there's another side to it, because on the other hand, I find it incredibly traumatic living through the last 10 minutes of a game when Chelsea are winning 1-0, and there's 10 minutes to go, and the sort of commentary is, and it's Burnley on the attack on the edge of the Chelsea penalty area. He shoots, Courtois dives, and oh my God, you know, I can hardly bear it. And if I die of heart failure, Chelsea are to blame. But this contrast...
Sorry.
This contrast with the serenity of watching county cricket at Lord's, and it's almost zen-like in engulfing me in a meditative zone of relaxation. And then the other one is music. The only thing in life to make me cry is music. It's very strange. Somebody could really analyse me, because really sad things that happen in my life don't make me cry. But happy things... like music, make me cry. So I can't explain that. But I was driving along recently, just about a week ago, and I had Frank Sinatra's Songs for Swinging Lovers on the stereo. Mm. And I realised I had tears flowing down my cheeks. It just moved me so much. And only music can do this. And, you know, I listened to God Only Knows, Tomorrow Never Knows, let's think, Joni's Court and Spark, Carole King's Tapestry, or London Calling, perhaps. And they take me to emotional areas that nothing else in life reaches.
Mm. Yeah. That's very, very interesting. But wonderful that music can do that.
What's your third, your top third choice of joy bringing in life, Jules?
Well, and this is going to sound extremely slushy, and I'm sorry for this, but actually, one of my great things is friends and people bonding over things. Mm. And you know, I was thinking about the moments of joy I've enjoyed in the last few weeks. So there was a festival that was on in Hastings called Beat Wave last weekend, which was loads of bands for free, and it was great. And afterwards, usually I spend Sunday dinner times at my parents' house in the evening. And actually, on this occasion, I went to the pub with my friends instead. It became apparent after 4 hours that I was the only person that needed to be at their desk the next day for 9 o'clock. So I left everybody else to continue to do their shots at 10 o'clock in the evening. But we had a lovely time. And at one point, so whoever it was that was DJing, I think it was my friend Letty in the other room, played Have I the Right by the Honeycombs. And I love this record so much. And of course, I did what I always do during this record, which was stamped loudly and sang the chorus. I once, years ago, took the sole off of one of my boots by stamping to this record. They were substandard. I bought them for a fiver. I think the problems were structural rather than specific. But I did this. And everyone else just thought it was the best thing ever. And I don't know why, because it was just, and everyone then started joining in. And I think one of my great joys, that you say, is people joining in with things. I mean, I posted something on my Facebook last night. I know Facebook gets a big knocking, and, you know, rightly so in some cases, but it is a way that people can kind of connect, I think, without really realizing it. And I just put this picture up that someone had posted of different shades of toast. And said, it said, tag your preferred shade of toast. And I just put it up and said, a test for all my chatty friends on FB. If anything, if you go for anything less than G or F, it's surely a crime against humanity, because it's tagged from A to I. Mm. And I thought, oh, well, maybe people will show some sort of interest in this. I'm not sure. You know, maybe a few people will chat along with me. It's still going this morning. People are still tagging there. But we're on 62 comments now. And people have just very much enjoyed joining in with their shades of toast. And I love my friends making me laugh. I think it's so fantastic. And someone has said, this just reminds me of the perils of making toast for other people. One ex rejected my toast because the butter hadn't been applied whilst it was still hot enough, like literally while still in the air popping out of the toaster. Another because he'd requested peanut butter, but I'd put normal butter on first. Oh, and gee, I would grudgingly eat H, but I'd be slightly irritable for the rest of the day. I love Facebook because it reminds me, I forget that I just think I'm really odd, and that my own preferences are really odd, and that, and this is, again, you could analyze this about me, I remember things about other people. So I remember things I've read or things they've said, and I for some reason, it's probably self-esteem links, and never assume the opposite. I always assume that people haven't remembered things about me, or they haven't listened or whatever. And I, when I DJed this wedding on Thursday night, I saw an old school friend from sixth form college, and I bumped into a nice woman there that was at sixth form college with us and her husband. And 2 years ago, we bumped into each other on a train. We do this. We bump into each other every few years and catch up. And I'd been going somewhere, and she'd been going up to London, and I'd been going to London en route somewhere else. And we talked about various things. And she remembered that conversation that we had, and she'd said about Brexit and things. And one of my great joys is the idea that, and this sounds a bit egotistical, and I don't mean it to, but that people joining in with each other, and also the idea that you know, people taking an interest in you, I suppose, really. And the idea that, you know, sort of the bonds between people, I think that's one of my great joys.
And you said it's sort of a simple pleasure, and my third one is also a very simple aspect of life, and it's walking, and I don't mean going to the shops.
Although it's good if you get to buy toast and stuff. Yeah.
Well, on the toast, honestly, anybody who I didn't want to go down this road because you know we're time bound here. But honestly, anybody who goes with toast,
we don't have several days, I'm afraid.
Less than on the verge of being burnt is a barbarian. Toast has to be well done. It isn't toast if it's just lightly. It's just been in the toaster for about 10 seconds, and people put it out, and you go, oh, look, there's a little tinge of brown on it. No, it has to be almost burnt black. That's the way to eat toast. But walking. I mean selecting somewhere really peaceful to walk, maybe 5 miles, and mainly for me, get away from London noise, hubbub. And it's amazing what a transformation it can make, well, certainly to me. And for example, over the last few weeks, I've walked the length of the River Wey in Surrey, which sounds dramatic, but it's only 19 and a half miles, and I've walked it twice. I've done it twice, but in segments of about 4 or 5 miles a go. And I really recommend this to anybody living in the sort of Home Counties area. It takes you right through the centre of Guildford, but also through some remote countryside at the foot of the Surrey Hills. And on one particularly quiet stretch between Godalming and Shalford, oh God, we saw a kingfisher, heron, dragonflies, deer, badgers, all life is there. Pillboxes from World War II all along the River Wey, fords, locks, tributaries, and also people you meet as you're walking along always sort of just have a smile and, oh, hello, you know, it's so peaceful. It's a world away from Trump and Brexit and the big bad world. So walking in serene locations is my third vote for things that bring joy.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. And I must come up. We must walk this together and have a real life podcast. That would be great.
And you know, the good thing is as well, if you walk the River Wey, is you don't need to take, you know, sometimes people say, oh, we're going walking over the Yorkshire Dells, and people take bottles of water and lunch and all sort of things.
And lots of Candlemen Cake.
All of that. But all along this walk along the River Wey, there's pubs about every 2 miles.
You are very much speaking my language.
You don't need to take any provisions with you if you just want to stop. There's pubs literally on the side of the river. So it's all there. Everything one needs is there. It's 50 years since gay rights were first established in the UK, so is everything okay now? That's coming up after Chainsmokers and the aforementioned Coldplay.
I've been reading books of old, the legends and the myths, Achilles and his gold, Achilles and his gifts, and Spider-Man's control, and Batman with his fist. And clearly I don't see myself upon that list. But she said, where'd you wanna go? How much you wanna risk? I'm not looking for somebody with some superhuman gifts. Some superhero, some fairy tale bliss. Just something I can turn to, somebody I can kiss. I want something just like this. Something just like this. Testaments they told, the moon and its eclipse, and Superman unrolls the suit before he lived. But I'm not the kind of person that it fits. She said, where'd you wanna go? How much you wanna risk? I'm not looking for somebody with some superhuman gifts, some superhero, some fairy tale bliss. Just something I can turn to, somebody I can miss. I want something just like this.
I heard that song for the first time a few days ago, and I literally cannot stop listening to it. I just love it. I think it's brilliant. And also, to bring it bringers of joy, I said to my mum, have you heard this record by Chainsmokers and Coldplay? Because my mum loves Coldplay and dance music, and that could have been sort of genetically made for my mum. She absolutely loves it. So yeah, that is Chainsmokers even, and Coldplay, and it's Something Just Like This.
And it was released earlier this year, and it's hard to find a country around the world where it wasn't a hit. They must be rolling it in, because when I checked it out, you know, sometimes when you look at a record's history, you know, you can see it's a hit in about 5 or even, you know, 8-9 places around the world. There's about 40 countries listed where it was in the top 5 all around the world. So yeah, hats off to Coldplay. Number 2 in the UK, number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100. Some terrible things have happened to people who identified as gay over the years. Of these things carried out often in the name of law and order. We need only look at the appalling treatment, go back as far as Oscar Wilde, Alan Turing, more latterly the hounding by the police of George Michael in Los Angeles, the grim humour of 1970s stand-up comedians who featured Billie Jean King, and from the same sport, the outing of Martina Navratilova by the New York Daily News. Now, I'm a straight man, so what do I know? I've never had direct experience of how it is or was being gay before 1967 or after. And I think we've come a distance and everything is better than it was. But I was reading a column by Owen Jones this week in which he says, we are less hated and judged than we were. But he also says, this is not something to be thankful for. Equality is not a privilege, he says. And that seems very valid to me. So should any celebrations of 50 years of gay rights be a qualified celebration, Jules?
Yes, I think that's probably right, actually. And the interesting thing was, is that we have come a long way in lots of ways, actually. And there's a really good BBC article on this saying 10 ways in which the UK has changed in that 50 years. And so we have got sort of social approval of same-sex relationships has really kind of risen, and particularly over the last 30 years. And approval is now extremely high. Having said that, though, you know, we're not in a society where everybody thinks that it is acceptable, which is still slightly astonishing to me, I must admit. I think that compared to 1967, and 1967, remember, and I think it's easy to forget this, it wasn't the end of the story. It benefited men that had sex with men only. So obviously, the fact that lesbianism has never been officially illegal hasn't necessarily meant that everybody has always thought it was okay. I can say that from a personal viewpoint. There have been various kind of key stages where it wasn't. So in 1967, what was decriminalised was sex between two men over 21 and in private. If there was anyone else in that house, it was not classed as private. Which is just jaw-dropping, really, isn't it? And I think, that was only in England. So it was decriminalised in Scotland in 1980 and Northern Ireland in 1982. The age of consent for two male partners was only lowered to 18 in 1994, and it was lowered to 16 in 2000, at which point the ban on gay and bisexual people were serving in the armed forces was lifted as well. Same-sex couples were only given equal rights for adoption in 2002. Gross indecency was still an offence until 2003. Then we had civil partnerships in 2004. And then gay marriage in 2014. And I must say at this point, credit where credit's due. So New Labour brought in civil partnerships on the basis that they didn't think they could get equal marriage past the church / the Lords / all that sort of thing at that point in time. David Cameron did get it past everybody. There was virtually nothing else that David Cameron did that I agree with, as we all know, and I will never forgive him the referendum. Having said that, he did. He was a heterosexual man. It wasn't his fight to have, I suppose you would say. You know, his own party. The only reason that equal marriage did get through was because of Labour votes, frankly, and in the Commons anyway. And it was an enormously risky thing for him to do, to set himself against his own party. People argue that Lynn Featherstone from the Lib Dems, because it was the coalition government, was instrumental in it, which is probably right. But, you know, I do admire Cameron for having that fight and getting it through when, you know, he had a lot to lose, I think, personally, through that. So I do at least begrudgingly respect him for that. I think that in terms of where we are now over here, our current Prime Minister, Theresa May, I say current, they're very much putting the emphasis on current nowadays, but her voting record was appalling on equal rights. It was really bad, and gradually it has improved, and she has apologised for her previous voting record.
She?
Yeah, she has, yeah. And Nicky Morgan as well had previously voted against gay marriage and then said that she had had her mind changed and that she was sorry for having voted previously. So in a way, that's a good thing. And it just goes to show the kind of, that without patronisingly talking about the pink pound, I'm glad we seem to be moving past the point of the gay rights lobby and moving into just, well, that's how it should be, just moving into kind of common sense equality. Having said that, what's going on in America at the moment with you know, President Trump, and what's and this recently in the news this week, the ban on transgender people serving the army, which is just, you know, outrageous. And what's happening over here, you know, the increasing importance of the DUP and some of their views on that sort of thing in our government here. I think what people like me, particularly people of my generation who came of age in the 90s under an extremely liberal, I mean, I have some problems with New Labour's record on civil liberties, but when it comes to sort of social liberties, you know, Tony Blair was extremely liberal on, you know, gay rights and immigration. And I think when you've grown up in that kind of atmosphere, it's easy to take it for granted. And this is where I do admire the Owen Jones piece and think it's going to be there forever. You know, now we've achieved these rights. I know that there's lots of chatter around The Handmaid's Tale at the moment that's been made into a drama, and the idea, a TV drama on Netflix, and the idea, or Hulu I think it was, and the idea that you know, one day we could wake up and rights could be taken away. And I think it's very, very easy to forget that, to think that the battles have been won and they are won forever. And, you know, the trend of this drift rightwards that we seem to be experiencing in different parts of the world at the moment does make me think, yes, isn't it great that we've come a long way? We're still not entirely equal. There are still societal attitudes that I think need to change. There are still, you know, difficulties in legislation. The blood ban, another piece of sort of news this week, that previously gay men have been banned from donating blood completely. That changed a while ago to 12 months since you'd had sex, I think, and now it's changed to 3 months. So I still think that it is, you know, I think it shows, it assumes that people of a certain sexuality have a certain lifestyle and have sex in a certain way. And I find that really difficult. So I still think that we are not quite at a point of equality. But I do think that even so, we do need to celebrate what we have achieved. But we do need to remember that it's not won forever. And I don't think the fight for equality ever stops.
I suppose, as with other areas of life, true equality can't said to be achieved until...
Until we're not talking about this anymore.
Yeah, someone's sexuality is no longer a defining feature, I think, is what I was going to say. So gay people shouldn't have to, you know, come out no more than a heterosexual person would have to discreetly tell parents and friends that they fancy people of the opposite sex. You know, mum, there's something I've got to tell you, kind of thing. And when that no longer happens, we'll have moved on. I think as many things in life, it's a generational thing. All the young people I know, family members, children and friends, don't give a thought to the sexual preferences of those around them, and that's the right approach. It isn't remarkable or for comment. It's whatever someone's preferences are, it's their business alone.
Absolutely. And you know, and actually, as I've grown older, and I don't know if it's me becoming more comfortable within myself or whether society being more comfortable with it, but I can, you know, muck about with other solicitors on the phone now at work. We were talking about having a chat with a very nice lady that was on the other side of a matter I had recently, and we were talking about, you know, how having kids and stuff, and she said she had unexpectedly had a child much later on in life. I think she was 46 when she had her child, and then promptly ended up dumping her husband because he turned out to be useless. And we were sort of she was sort of asking about me, and I said, to be honest, if I'd ever become pregnant at any point, I think my ex-girlfriends probably would have had fairly searching questions to answer. and it's great that I can make a joke like that and people think it's really, really funny, and people just laugh at the joke and they don't have a problem with what's underlying the joke. And occasionally I still do get people, usually men that I don't know very well, I've recently met, making jokes about sort of boyfriends and things, and it's amazing how, they mean nothing by it, but it's just one of those things, and they're usually a bit embarrassed when I gently correct them, but it's one of those things where I don't know if that's equality or not, really, in that people still, you know, people still make assumptions, I suppose, really, but they don't mean it unkindly, I suppose. Okay. But not everybody's gonna, you know, we will have equality when everyone, no one makes assumptions anymore, I suppose, really. And these are tradesmen, bless them, so it's all right.
Now, you, of course, are the fourth element that brings joy into my life.
And likewise, Terence, I just want to make that... I listened back to our podcast last week and I did have a bit of a go at you, so I'm sorry for that. I am a fan.
Where might you be spreading your joy this coming week?
Well, this coming week, I am spreading the joy. I will be doing, I think I'm doing my Saturday social this evening. I do need to confirm that. So it's unconfirmed at the time of going to press. I'm also DJing at someone's house party this evening, which I'm very much looking forward to. Happy 50th to Ruth. I also am doing the Indie Wonderland next Wednesday the 2nd of August, from 8 until 10 p.m. on barricaderadio.com, where I do indie, alt-rock and miscellaneous type things. Oh, by the way, if the Saturday social does happen, that's 6 to 7 p.m. this Saturday on the same station, barricaderadio.com.
Thanks to our thoroughly splendid executive producer Rona.
Yes, indeed, remaining a fan of Rona and all that she does.
I love The Cure so much, and Robert Smith, absolutely inspirational. He just keeps going, does his own thing, a really unique presence in music since the mid-1970s. And to play us out, from 1980, their first hit single here in the UK, this is The Cure and A Forest.
Thank you. You have been listening to a DACA Media production.